Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First and Ask Questions Later. I am joined by Rabbi Elchanan Pupko, and today we are going to be discussing two seemingly disjointed topics. We're going to be talking about the major bas mitzvah controversy of the 20th century, and we're also going to talk about dishwashers a little bit as well. And I guess the common theme ostensibly is that they both appear in the same tshuva of Igros Moshe. But in particular, what interests us, and especially our esteemed guest who's with us today, is that there's a particular family connection, which will give us a little bit of an understanding of the context that Rav Moshe Feinstein addresses both of these questions in. But before I give the mic over to Rabbi Pupko, we should just know a little bit about him. He's a New England-based, Baruch Hashem, see, we're neighbors. New England-based 11th generation rabbi, very impressive, teacher and author. He has written sacred days on the Jewish holidays and Pupko on the Parsha, as well as hundreds of articles published in five languages. Wow, okay, other than English and Hebrew, which I presume are two of them, what are the other three languages?
So I wrote an article, I actually wrote an article in Yiddish, that I speak Yiddish, so that's that. And then I, Pupko on the Parsha, I believe, was translated to French and to Spanish. And I also published, I didn't write it and I don't speak Arabic, just a few words. I put also a Haggadah in Arabic out. So those are
wow, that is, that's language. Really cool stuff. And okay, so wonderful. And so why don't we jump in? Usually I like to ask the guest who comes on to just share with us why they chose this tshuva out of old tshuvos. Now, just for reference, you're going to mention a few tshuvos that your family interacted with Rav Moshe Feinstein. But for our listeners in particular, we're looking at Or HaChaim Chelek Aleph Simon Kuf Dalid. But why don't you tell us about your personal connection, your family connection with Rav Moshe Feinstein, these tshuvas in Igros Moshe, and you know, what topics that they make an appearance in Igros Moshe in?
Yes, I think this tshuva, and in general other tshuvas that my grandfather from Pittsburgh, Rabbi Baruch Pupko, got from Rav Moshe, have to do with a very important question, and with a theme of Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvas, which is why his tshuvas are so important. And the theme is really American Orthodoxy coming into being. Yes, there were Orthodox Jews in America for hundreds of years. You have the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. In the late 1800s, you have the Lower East Side starting to get more and more Jews by the millions, literally. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, who, by the way, did live on the Lower East Side, is the most respected, the most widely respected halachic decider who was really making these decisions about what Judaism in America should look like, especially in light of the fact that many of the immigrants to America were coming from Eastern Europe, and they wanted to know how to practice Judaism of old in the new country. And so whether it's the tshuva on Chal V'Yisrael, whether you need Chal V'Yisrael or not, cars, elevators, mechitzas, all these questions are questions, and this relates also to the question of bat mitzvah, it's questions that often German Jews and what we call, I guess, Western Orthodoxy, whether it's Spanish, Portuguese, or German Jews, have already addressed for more than 100 years. But the people like me, the Ostjuden, as they were called, the Eastern Jews, we you know, just arrived from the shtetl. And so the question was, if you want to, yes, there were the Eastern European Jews who became cowboys and moved to Middle America, and they didn't really have much infrastructure. But then there were the American Orthodox Jews who came from Eastern Europe, and they wanted to keep Judaism the way it was in the old country under new circumstances. And that's where Moshe comes in to deal with questions, which in many ways he's dealing with them as if they just happened. In other ways, you can say, well, oh, you know, for example, this question of bat mitzvahs, The Aruch Laner dealt with it, and it was dealt with in Germany more than 100 years prior.
Right, I think there's a tshuva, the Sridi Eish also.
The Sridi Eish is more of a contemporary of Rav Moshe, but the discussions about Bat Mitzvah go more than 100 years back, actually. What he's doing is he's really addressing questions to an audience of Eastern European Jews who want to know how to keep Judaism in the way they have been keeping it, and they want to hear from someone who they respect, which is obviously Rav Moshe, whose scholarship was unquestionable. Another way where this, you know, where you came from in Europe matters is the discussion of an Eruv. So Rav Moshe Feinstein is asked about whether you can have an Eruv in Manhattan, and he says, of course you cannot, because it's a big city. Now, you'll have suddenly other Jews who say, what do you mean? We had an Eruv in Warsaw. Warsaw is a big city. But I can tell you as a Litvak that the distance between Warsaw and Vilna is extraordinarily big, not in miles as much as in the culture. So that's what's coming to Ramosha, and he's making these decisions for a newly blended community. And so my grandfather, who was a rabbi in Pittsburgh, Rabbi Baruch Popko, he was a rabbi in Pittsburgh for 60 years. He founded the Hillel Day School there. He helped supervise the Ashgacha on Heinz, so that Heinz ketchup and all those which were in Pittsburgh could be kosher. And that's also something he sent Rav Moshe. He was really dealing also with these sort of building blocks of American Orthodoxy. How do you run a Jewish day school? How do you run a Hashgacha on a commercial company as large as Heinz when all of the rules of the old country cannot really... Well, the rules can apply, but the circumstances, I promise you, there was nothing in my grandfather's town where he was born, whether it was the Velizh or later he was in Radin, there was nothing like Heinz. So you had to figure these things out. And so then one of the questions that he asks Rav Moshe is about this Bat Mitzvah custom, which was going on in America, was going on in Western Europe. But, in Eastern Europe, it was unheard of. And like we're going to see, even the practice, I remember hearing, I don't know if this is, you know, where this comes from my grandfather, who, by the way, had an immense sense of humor. So the saying was, in Europe, you were lucky if you got a piece of herring for your bar mitzvah.
I hope I'm not misquoting. If I remember correctly, Rav Tendler, Zichrono Livracha, was telling me that I guess about Rav Moshe, that back in, you know, the Altaheim, that when they got a new species of potato or something, they made a shechianu on it. Talk about how impoverished that they were back then.
Exactly. And add to that the very Lithuanian character that we have at Litvaks, which I'm very proud of, which is, in general, we abhor celebrations. Any reason to be happy is not necessary. You know, that they have the joke about what's the highlight of Purim for Litvaks?
Oh, I was just about to tell you that one. Please, go for it.
So the highlight is where the parts that they read in the tunes of Tisha B'Av of Eicha, but they don't do too much because it's going to be too happy.
Don't want to give them too much simcha.
Yeah, and you could look up. I mean, not to say that there were different forms of joy, but you look up Lithuanian Jewish tunes, you won't find. Lithuanian Jewry contributed to the most remarkable intellectual works that whether it's the yeshiva system and the chidushim that they had, but celebrations have not been our strong side. So bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs were not happening in any significant way. And in Eastern Europe, and in general, the Jewish approach, whether it's in Lithuania or in the times of the Talmud, has been a gradual introduction, meaning the Gemara says that everything you do whenever you're ready for it. So a kid starts keeping Shabbos in some ways when they're two or three, and then they start washing their hands, and then they maybe put on tzitzis, or they start whatever it may be. They do gradually, and putting on tefillin was done in many places. Yemenite Jews and Sephardic Jews, I think, do it to this day. You put them on when you're 12. So what does it really mean to celebrate a bar mitzvah? Because, you know, people were introduced to mitzvahs based on whatever it was that they were getting prepared for and ready for. So when you were 9 years old, if you were ready to fast on Yom Kippur, 10, whatever it is, you did that. And so the idea of having a sort of a red line where it all starts was not a celebration in Eastern Europe, at least.
So you're saying, I might be jumping the gun, but even before we get to the context of American Jewry and the battle with conservative and I guess also reform ideology, you're saying is that this just wasn't part of the ethos. This wasn't part of the culture of Litvish Jewry to make all these big ceremonies and celebrations, even if it was within a vacuum and it wasn't about being on the defense against other movements.
Obviously Rav Moshe's considerations were halachic and also in terms of the reform and conservative. But yeah, in general, Litvaks, I mean, there's a famous story that's said as a greatness story. I know some people will think it's you know, they won't be impressed. But Rav Elchanan Wasserman, one of the stories of the Gedolim about him is that he got a telegram when he was in the Beis Medrash that he had a baby boy, I think. And they said, are you going to go travel for the bris? He said, I'm not a mohel. And he just stayed in yeshiva. And that was like I mentioned something. I was speaking to the Israeli ambassador in Vilna, and I told her that a big insult that Lithuanian Jews once invoked was that this rabbi must have written this book when he was drinking tea with sugar, because he was so materialistic and decadent that he put sugar in his tea. That's why his book is a low-level book. So yeah, in general, it's not a... Which is why, just another example, upsherons today are considered standard, where it was, I think, completely unheard of among Lithuanian Jews. There's a story I heard about Rav Baruch Kovarsky, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ponovich, who knew his grandchildren. He knew them. They were, you know, running around his house. And his family, since they moved to Israel and since upsherons became more popular, grew the kid's hair till he was three. And his Rav Kovarsky's daughter brings the kid over to him, showing him, like, after the upshare, and he looks up from his Gemara and he says, oh, he got a haircut, and just continued learning. no meaning whatsoever. And today you have people who do upshares for tens of thousands of dollars. So these celebrations are appreciated. Birthdays, and I think the Lubavitcher Rebbe was the first one to formalize them, but other Litvaks will tell you that the only person to celebrate their birthday in Tanakh is
Paro.
That's it. And it wasn't uncommon for Jews to not know their birthdays because, you know, nobody, there was no celebration involved. So that in mind, Rav Moshe comes to America and he sees what was already a phenomenon in Germany 100 years earlier, which is that you have people doing a bar mitzvah as sort of a similar to confirmation. So people are doing bar mitzvahs, and that's what he writes in this tshuva. He says, if I could, I would cancel bar mitzvahs as well. So there's
yeah, really, if I may, I want to actually emphasize that line, because I have my Igros Moshe with me, and when I looked at this tshuva a while ago, I see I apparently double underlined that, because I think, you know, I'll ask you in a moment just to give an overview of, which I think we're about to get to, about Rav Moshe's opposition to bas mitzvahs. But I think that's something like what you just mentioned, that many people, when they're having discourse about this, they overlook that one line for Rav Moshe where he says, V'yasher echeli ha'yisim evaltim yinusinu gam seida ha'bar mitzvah shel ha'banim. I would also get rid of the bar mitzvah.
By the way, more power
ceremonies.
To him. But then he mentions
the issue is, you know, Mishum Chil Shabbos as well. Like, there's a few reasons why.
Because it's
be
the
opposed.
American bar mitzvah, right, correct.
People are going to drive in for the bar mitzvah and cause work. Yeah. And of course, Rav Moshe was, you know, wrote that whole tshuva against rabbis who invite people to come to shul, and full well knowing they'll drive, that's not just lifnei iver, but they're a masis, they're inciting people to sin. So yeah. You know, I think it's within that context of Rav Moshe fighting against the whole driving to shul that the conservative movement, of course, they legitimize for their people.
Yeah, look, the issue of the issue of how to distinguish yourself from conservative and reform Jews is something that always has haunted Orthodoxy since the birth of the Reform and Conservative movements. And there's no question that Orthodoxy today has been shaped in many ways by the opposition to being Reform and conservative. And that's because many of the early Reform, and not conservative, but early Reform did want to be similar to the Christian churches. Mm-hmm. So you have Bar Bat Mitzvah confirmation. And so how do you look? If I lived in the 1960s and you asked me about the raging war, which didn't start in the 60s, started even earlier on mechitzas, I would think about it. I'd be like, I don't know, mechitza, how important is that in halacha? Is that something, a hill I'm going to die on? No. But in retrospect, 1,000% Rav Moshe was right. That was a fight that I have no halachic proof for this, but that defined what communities would remain, how observant in many ways. And in that sense, I think history has vindicated him. Are other cases, weddings inside shuls that the Chassam Sofer fought against vehemently is another question. You know, people do have weddings inside shuls today. The topic of umbrellas on Shabbos, I don't want to mention any heretical opinions here, but an umbrella forbidden on Shabbos is definitely tangentially related to things that Reform Jews in Hungary were doing. So the battle over identity definitely extended to many fields.
Right. And I think that's a very, you know, salient point in these tshuvos that Rav Moshe, he explicitly calls out Reform and conservative. He doesn't, he doesn't have any pretense of not combating them. He puts that out on the table. If we were to apply some Lumdisha jargon over here, we could almost say, is this a simen or a siba? Is it that this whole argument is just a general symbolic argument, an opposition to something which is non-Orthodox? Or do you see, you know, just walk us through this tshuva over here. Does Rav Moshe make any halachic arguments, or at least arguments that are external to the need to combat and distinguish us from the non-Orthodox movements?
Yeah, so his main argument is in terms of the sanctity of a shul, and that you cannot hold in shul any ceremonies that are not direct davening, which, by the way, I think most Orthodox synagogues today are not true to. Meaning, I don't know of a Orthodox synagogue that will not, maybe one or two in Brooklyn, but I don't know of many Orthodox synagogues that will do nothing in the sanctuary other than pray and have Torah study. Meaning, when you have a guest speaker, you have a simcha, you have something like that, the issue of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses and making sure that you do in it nothing else, including, and this is very severe, no eating in shul. How many shuls do you know that nobody will eat in shul?
Right. So that's because usually we build a shul. Now, Rav Moshe deals with this. Al Tanai, that could be like a base medrash. Now, just because something's a base medrash doesn't give you carte blanche permission to eat and drink. You have to be, you know, someone who learns in the base medrash. But what's interesting is Rav Moshe mentions at the beginning of the tshuva, he says, Af benivnu al Tanai, even if this base HaKnesses is stipulated that you could do other things in there, he seems to still be opposed to having a bas mitzvah ceremony. So I'm just trying to understand, like, what's going on at this bas mitzvah ceremony that would make it worse than, you know, I don't know, some sort of Israel fundraiser going on.
Yeah. Which, I mean, maybe he's opposed to that also. A very interesting fact is that we're getting a lot of American Orthodox sociology, is that I believe Rav Moshe, definitely Rav Ruderman, spoke at UJA JNF appeals before the Satmar Rebbe pulled Orthodoxy to the right on those issues. And those were held in synagogues. So, look, but the halachic, maybe I'm missing something. The halachic reason he invokes is the issue of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. And then he says, even at home, you definitely can't hold it as a Sudas Mitzvah. And 20 years after this tshuva is written, Rav Ovadia Yosef says that you make a Shechianu. Rav Yitzhak Nissim says you do celebrate it. and those things, like I said, have to do with distinction from reform. I will say something very important, and that is occasionally in my work, I'm sure that you came across this as well, you'll meet Jews who are not Orthodox at all, with no exposure to Orthodoxy, and they'll say, well, I've met people in their 60s, 70s, they'll say, well, I wasn't bat mitzvah, I wasn't bar mitzvah. And that is a dangerous understanding. The idea that somehow if you didn't have that ceremony, you are not actually Jewish, that is a dangerous idea. And that is something that, you know, needs to be countered. And I think that's what he was countering, the idea that you become somehow Jewish by having a ceremony in synagogue, which is completely Christian. Yeah, whether you had a bar mitzvah, you didn't have a bar mitzvah, you're the same Jewish. Sometimes you see also these social media posts, oh, this guy is 98 years old, or there was even a guy 113 and he just celebrated his bar mitzvah, a very special man, by the way. You can look that story up, a Holocaust survivor. He had his bar mitzvah at the age of 113. There's this some kind of understanding of there's no meaning whatsoever to having a bar mitzvah at 95, right? It's completely meaningless. The idea of bar mitzvah is just marking your 13th or 12th birthday, whenever you've become a grown person. If you didn't have the ceremony, you still became Jewish and bar mitzvah and what have you now. You're an adult. You know, I guess you have two types of mistakes. Some people think that they're not adults if they didn't have the bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Some people think they're not Jewish. Neither is true.
It's like almost the svara behind Tosefes Shabbos, that you don't just wait for Shabbos to happen. You know, you anticipate the, you market yourself.
Look, the amazing thing about bar and bat mitzvahs is that if you go to the most Haredi circles, I have no question, by the way, that Rav Moshe's grandchildren and great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren themselves all have bar mitzvahs and probably also bas mitzvahs.
So, but when you say that, you know, the question is, so I have family, we went to a few years back to a bas mitzvah in the family in Passaic, New Jersey. So that's like a typical, you know, I guess more moderate yeshivish community or standard yeshivish community. So they don't do any ceremony in the Beis HaKnesses, in the sanctuary of the shul. What they did is they have a nice little party. She actually got up there and gave a Dvar Torah. It was mostly family, a few of her friends. Mm-hmm. So Rav Moshe, like you said, his main opposition seems to be about doing it in the context of the shul and taking what is seemingly a more, I don't know if secular is the right word, but something that's not a religiously mandated ritual and turning it into some sort of ceremony and presentation in the shul. If I could say I think also we have to think about what's the goal behind these ceremonies. So I forget if it's Rav Avadia's tshuva. It might be Rav Avadia's tshuva or it's a Sri Asia's tshuva. When I glanced at it, one of the arguments was that these ceremonies actually lehepach, they're strengthening Torah observance because this girl gets to mark this occasion in her life that she's going to be keeping mitzvahs on a higher level. But you know what's fascinating, and I'm going to share with you this little story. I hope I say this in a politically correct way. So we've been talking about bas mitzvah ceremonies. There's also bar bas mitzvah parties, which seem to come along with it. And I'll just tell you, I'll just tell you a story that, our shul rents out there. We have a lot of space, Baruch Hashem, and they rent out to families. It could be people who are not affiliated with the shul and they want to have a bar bas mitzvah party. So on Sukkot, a year or two ago, there was a bas mitzvah taking place at the shul. Now, because I'm in an apartment building, we don't have our own sukkah. So I go over to the sukkah in the shul to eat, and I could hear the music blasting out of the building. And I can't even say the lyrics. I won't utter the lyrics that I hear in that music coming from the bas mitzvah party that I heard as I was eating and making my leis shave in the sukkah. So, you know, you almost wonder if these parties and the culture around bar bas mitzvah is actually facilitating more observance of mitzvahs, or if it's, you know, detracting from how we understand what Judaism is meant to be. Sorry if I'm going on the rant over here.
I hear you. Let's work backwards here. To be very specific, what Rav Moshe opposed is the idea that you come to a synagogue and that the presence of a member of clergy is what makes you Jewish. Mm. That is true to this day. There is zero basis in Judaism for a ceremony that says, if you come to the synagogue and you do this and this, you are Jewish. Otherwise, you are not. No, that's not true. And that's what he opposed. And that's a Christian influence that is just not true for our faith. And that's it. And you can work backwards from there. That is what he was excluding. Now, do people do parties? Yes, God bless them. Let them in. You know, people do, like I told you, people do upsharons, which are absolutely unproportionate. There's made up customs from here until tomorrow. You know, I always find it funny around Yom HaTzmaut. You always have online or in person people who make fun of saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. And I look at the guy because usually it's people who observe other un-Lithuanian customs. And, you know, the guy's like, oh, they're saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. And I'm like, dude, you celebrate an upsharon, you celebrate this, you celebrate all these made-up things. You go to Uman and Meron and whatever that is much less grounded in halacha than having a Hallel on a day.
So what if I'm consistent and do neither of them?
Then and you sit and learn Gemara, then you're a real litvak. Yeah, look, people look for reasons to celebrate. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think you know, if people do upsharons and they enjoy it, and they enjoy having, by the way, the same thing. People have a vort, a lechayim, a ofrof, a Shabbos Shavrochus. All these things did not exist. Not all of them, but nobody in the old country did all of those celebrations, right? No one had an ofrof, a wedding, a l'chaim, a vort, an ofrof, a Shabbos Sheva Brachas, a Shabbos Chasan, Shabbos Kala. People didn't have the resources or the joy to do these things. So, right.
I think it's also important, like what you're saying, is to understand, even if you want to throw extra parties, like just be clear and know what's religiously mandated and what you're doing for fun under the guise of religion.
I don't know. I'm not that against fun. Look, I was born on Yom Kippur, which is a tough time for a bar mitzvah. So I got an aliyah on Yom Kippur. Then Shabbos Bereishis I read. Then we had a during the week part. There were multiple. Okay, people do these things. It's not a terrible thing.
Right. So as we're, you know, I want to wrap up the bat mitzvah discussion just a moment, though. I feel like you and I could go on for this for a while because we want to talk about dishwashers. Do you have any sense, I guess, final question on this? Do you have any sense why this particular psak of Moshe was not successful?
So just
in terms of its reception,
the question was a completely separate question that my grandfather asked him. Was can you use the same dishwasher for milchik and fleishik, for dairy and meat? And Rav Moshe says, yes, as long as you change the racks, you can have the same dishwasher. Now, Rav Moshe, even though he was one of the most brilliant, if not the most brilliant man of his generation, he never envisioned a world in which Jews will have the suburban types of houses that you see in Lakewood and Teaneck and other places where people have two dishwashers, two ovens, two microwaves. I don't think anyone on the Lower East Side ever, in fact, to this day, I don't think anyone dreams about that. But the question was if you can have, and nobody really does that today. Nobody uses the same dishwasher for milchik and fleishik, even though Rav Moshe says there that you can. So I would say that even though Rav Moshe is by far the most American posek in terms of setting standards, in both of those cases, bar bat mitzvah and in terms of milchik fleishik dishwashers, it seems like, you know, 100 years, or sorry, what are we at? 80 years later, those psakim did not resonate as much as other of his other psakim, and as they say in the Gemara, puk chazi mai ama devar, go see what the common custom is, and the same is true for 1,000 other things, from upsharons to going to kivrei tzadikim in large numbers, and all kinds of other things where litvaks did not get our way.
Right. I feel like, obviously, I don't want to take us to a field. I feel like Kivrei Tzadikim gets a bad rap, but You look at Midrashim, Yeshua and Kalev going to visit the Avos when they come to Eretz.
We can do a separate episode on this.
I know is much more controversial.
I will tell you that Kivrei Tzadikim number one, the vast majority, I don't want to say something so big, but an extraordinary amount of these Kvarim are not actually the Kvarim. There's zero evidence. The one caver that people that should be going to that they don't go to is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi in Beit She'arim, which archaeologists assert is indeed his caver near Haifa. The Opsharon's Kvarim, all these things that people enjoy.
Well, I think the a Kvarim, if I remember it, maybe it's the Mishnah Berurah or I saw somewhere else, that there's really two goals. One is to ask the tzaddik to intercede for you, but the other one is just to have that more of that avira, that atmosphere.
Let me ask you a question.
To Kvarim also. So
but happens to be my grandfather knew the Chofetz Chaim, and my great uncle was a very close Talmud of his. If you asked him if he would ever believe that hundreds of thousands of Jews would leave Eretz Yisrael in America to go to Uman, to where I don't even want to, what's the place? Rav Shail is the new trend. I don't think they would, the idea that you're leaving your family, you're spending such resources. I don't think they would even begin to fathom such a thing. But all good.
So with the, we only have a few minutes left, but so I think what you just mentioned was that this psak against bas mitzvah ceremonies and this psak to accommodate a single dishwasher for meat and dairy on separate racks, one after the other, both of them didn't seem to enjoy as wide reception as some of his other rulings that he's given. Is there any reason in particular, or is it just kind of, it's hard to really pinpoint why some caught on, why some didn't. And I think this is just like a more general question for Rav Moshe. I think we can even ask, I don't know if you're prepared to address this, which is Rav Moshe, of course, was a posik par excellence, but there were also other Gedolei HaPoskim that were his contemporaries. And I always just wonder how did it develop that Rav Moshe became the posik hador when others who were on the same, again, who am I to start comparing all these things? I'm offered tachas regleim, but how did it come to be that Rav Moshe was the grand posek? And if that is true, why did these rulings seem to not be as widely accepted as one would think?
So first of all, the reason
with our 3 minutes that we have left,
the reason he became such a posek, two things. Number one, his knowledge and brilliance were unparalleled. Another tshuva that we didn't speak about is from my great-grandfather, Rav Eliezer Popko. It's really just a question in learning. And Rav Moshe sits and writes 3, 4, or 5 pages as an answer to him on a random topic, not halacha l'maaseh. So I think just his ability to elaborate on every single topic in anything, that earns him just the brilliance and the availability. The fact that he was the one to pick up his phone. And part of this is actually terrifying, but all of our rabbis pretty much were killed in the Holocaust. Not all, but a huge amount. And so he got out when my great-grandfather got out, he got out in the early 1930s. And a huge amount of people either died in the gulags or in the Holocaust. And so to have a gaon of such a scope in America was unheard of, and the fact that he also was practical. You cannot suspect him, especially based on this, you cannot suspect him of being too progressive, being too lenient. But on the other hand, he does understand what people were going through. He does have the tshuva permitting using chalav stam and many other things. So I think his understanding of what Jews were going through, working in sweatshops and the difficult reality of America, while being passionate about preserving what was, I think all those things make him by far the most American posek.
Wow. That very well said and well articulated. And I would just add one thing that Rav Tendler, my Rebbe, his son-in-law, so Rav Tendler Zichrono Livracha told me, I hope I'm not botching the details, that toward the end, or almost at the very end of Rav Moshe's life, he was crying out of gratefulness to God. And he said to Rav Tendler, I'm grateful that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the strength that there was never a shaila that I wasn't able to find the ability and time to respond to. And I think that speaks to your point about his availability, is that there's even if there's, you know, others out there who are had the same level of brilliance as, and other Gedolei HaPoskim that he went toe to toe with, I'm not saying anything against them, Chas v'Shalom, but something remarkable about Rav Moshe is that he made himself available to answer all these different kinds of questions, that he was pragmatic, he understood the situation on the ground, and when he didn't understand the situation on the ground, he would seek to hear from the experts, and of course Rav Tendler would advise him on the medical aspects. So I think this gives me an appreciation for Rav Moshe Feinstein. I hope it gives our listeners a greater appreciation for why we refer to Igros Moshe so much, and why it's very hard for me to do a podcast episode that we don't talk about Igros Moshe, either as the primary tshuva or at least as a reference, because it's just been such a profound and fundamental part of what it means to be a Jew living in America and really in the world writ large. So do you have any, I don't want to cut you short, any final words that you want to share with our listeners before we conclude?
Thank you for this. Is I just cannot thank you enough for this and all the other good work that you do and the Torah teaching that you do. It's really always an inspiration to see. And I think the topic of Shailos Utshuvos, for some reason, which maybe I'm missing something, but is very lacking in our generation. I can tell you that as a rabbi, I don't see many of my colleagues writing tshuvas to or receiving tshuvas, definitely not as extensive as you would see from Rav Moshe, from Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and others. And I think almost a lost art to many. And it's such a beautiful thing that you focus on this Shailos Utshuvos, which is, it has the benefit, number one, of understanding Torah, number two, understanding Torah scholars, and number three, understanding the realities of every generation, which when historians want to understand the generation, they go look at the Shailos Utshuvos books.
Wow. I should hire you. If we ever need to make a commercial for Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, I'm hiring you to write the script for that.
Come on.
Thank you for your really kind words. And thank you for all those who are listening today. Shkayach for your wisdom. And I know you have so much more Torah, so much more history to share. So everyone should go make sure to check out Rabbi Pupko on social media. Where's the best place, very briefly, for people to follow you if they want to learn your Torah?
I think I don't know that I'm always posting on social media about Shailos Utshuvos, but I have the Pupko on the Parsha. I have an article on every Parsha, on every I have the sacred days on the holidays, and you can find the article from me on every single Parsha holiday, so you can look those up.
All right, so maybe you'll send it to me. I could put a link in the description. And all right, make sure to check it out. Thank you so much for your time. And God willing, looking forward to learning again very soon.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you for
Take care. Bye. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.